The Canby Report was produced and recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations.
There once was a man named Larry Beasley who built the city of glass by the sea. His name lives on for the plans he wrought called the Vancouver Model. May another planner come to build housing for all incomes, and when the city plan is done, we'll make Vancouver grow. Thence Calgary came to Derry on industrial lands fought for, but then his ego clashed with management and they had to let him go. May another planner come to build housing for all incomes, and when the city plan is done, we'll make Vancouver grow. Gregor then brought in Jackson to be vision planning. Yes, man, with the architects he sparked a row and he opted to step down. May another planner come to build housing for all incomes. When the city plan is done, we'll make Vancouver grow. Last came a man named Gil Kelly for the missing middle to build, you see. But he ran up against the bureaucracy, back to Oregon he goes. May another planner come to build housing for all incomes, and when the city plan is done, we'll make Vancouver grow.
Oi mateys, the date is March 31st, 2021, and there be 563 days until the Vancouver municipal elections. This is the Canby Report. I'm Matthew Naylor.
And I'm Ian Bushfield.
Thank you for indulging us.
I hope you liked our original studio recording.
Remember when we had an actual studio?
It was nice, but those are not socially distant.
Yeah, there were microphones and everything, and we'd, like, be enunciating so much, we'd be spitting on each other. Holy shit, what a time. Well, if we ever want to get back there, one thing that we are going to need is continual funding to pay for that studio space. And if people want to support that, because, man, this thing has got to end at some point, people can visit patreon.com/CanbyReport.
Patreon.com/CanbyReport.
That's right, Ian. Patreon.com/CanbyReport. If you or one of your dearest loved ones wants to contribute to citizen journalism in Vancouver, you can go visit that website and pledge. We provide not only the number one source of citizen journalism in Vancouver, but also a very active and interesting Slack channel that you have access to, as well as first dibs at events, you know. Those things that we have.
Once upon
a
time.
We should do, yeah, like when we're allowed to do park stuff again, we should do something in the park sometime. But man, what a help every single dollar is on that thing. I do want to say that, like, at least personally, this pandemic has been hard for me, and I have gotten through it in no small part because of my ability to do this and to share my thoughts with you, and the fact that we have a dedicated and very engaged listener base is really heartwarming to me, and I just wanted to express my gratitude there for that. But in that spirit, we have a ton on the agenda today, so why don't we get to it?
Well, let's jump in first to the news out of New Westminster. Kind of broke yesterday, the decision came out today, that New Westminster has won its challenge. A group of landlords had challenged the rental-only zoning bylaw that the city brought in, wanting to prevent the building that they own property in from being switched to a permanent rental-only building.
What a win this is for people who, like, support rental housing. It is a huge deal that will impact not only New Westminster, but also almost all the other rental-only zoning bylaws that have been enacted in BC under the doctrine of stare decisis. You are bound by previous decisions of the court. This will provide an incredibly important tool for the courts going forward to uphold rental housing bylaws. And so this is a huge win for everyone.
Yeah, the decision was rendered by the Honorable Mr. Justice A. Saunders. Like I said, it just came out today, so I haven't had a chance to dig through it very deeply. I did jump kind of right down to the end where the good stuff always is. The facts are kind of fun, but it's always you know, skip to the end of the decision. You don't need to go through all of the boring stuff. And like, was this a reasonableness or correctness standard? The perpetual debate in Canadian law. 90% of you won't care. The other 10% care a lot.
My suspicion is that, as with almost all things, it was a reasonableness standard. But honestly, I think this probably could have held up under correctness. I didn't actually get a chance to go through the decision as closely as I would have liked. Did they end up coming down on reasonableness or correctness?
I think it came down to more of a jurisdictional question in the end. I honestly skimmed through the standard of review stuff. The fun part was on line 69 after all the discussion of whether there's a jurisdictional conflict here, and the judge just writes, the notion of a jurisdictional conflict here is a chimera. It's just a fun little phrase. Basically, the final paragraphs highlight that the purpose of the rental-only zoning bylaw was to allow cities to create rental-only zoning. So the justice concludes, it cannot be unreasonable for the city to have enacted a bylaw that precisely accomplishes the legislature's purpose.
So one thing that I think we've actually thrown up a bit of a red herring there, unfortunately, because this is them suing over the constitutionality of the legislation, whether or not this is constitutional. So it's not actually going to come down to a reasonableness or correctness standard. It's going to come down to a constitutional or non-constitutional standard. Just as I'm skimming over right now, it's another principle from administrative law as to whether or not this is intra vires, which is within the powers, intra within the vires, the powers, or extra vires or ultra vires, rather, which is outside the powers of the municipality in order to do this. So in admin law, there are decisions that are made by a administrative tribunal or a government or whatever. In this case, it's one of those weird half and half situations because municipal governments function both as administrative tribunals and as governments. But basically, the situation is that the legislation that was passed by the city council, the bylaw, was intra vires, which is within the powers of the municipality under the Municipal Governments Act and the RRT Amendment Act. Citing specifically line 72, under the city's interpretation of the RRT Amendment Act, bylaw 8123 is accomplishing the precise aims of the legislation. It serves the remedial purpose of enabling the city to prevent an owner from converting a rented strata into a unit that is owner-occupied, thus preserving the city's stock of available rental housing. That purpose does impinge on the property rights of owners, but that is what the legislation, reasonably interpreted, appears to have intended. It cannot be unreasonable for the city to have enacted a bylaw that precisely accomplishes the legislature's purpose. There is simply no validity to an attack on bylaw 8123 as unreasonable but otherwise intra vires bylaw. So what that means is that the plaintiffs were challenging this based on two categories. One, that this was an unreasonable restriction on property rights, presumably, which don't really exist in Canada. And two, that it was ultra vires the city's powers. And the courts disagreed and found in favor of the city. So that is fantastic.
Yeah, it looks like the petitioners threw out another sort of hypothetical example of an owner who was living in it, but at the exact time of the bylaw being brought in, was renting it out, but was planning to come back and live there. And the court was just kind of dismissed that, going, well, if and when that hypothetical is reality, they can then sue. And we can debate that, but those facts aren't in question here. You can't just, I mean, you can throw hypotheticals at the court, I imagine, but not to that level.
You can, but like the court is very good at going and batting hypotheticals away. Well, as BC descends into another period of lockdown, seeing as how all in-person dining has been banned for the next 2.5 weeks now, with our circuit breaker of restrictions, which, I mean, I have many thoughts about, but the patio program has mercifully been extended. So, bad for Michael Weeb, good for everyone else.
Yeah, it was announced earlier this week, Mayor Kennedy Stewart was seeking council's approval through an emergency motion to extend the thing that wasn't controversial other than his one vote where everyone else voted for it. Michael Wiebe, that is. It's good to see, like, there's very little restaurants can do right now, and they're struggling, and this was sprung on them. I mean, looking at the numbers, it wasn't surprising this was brought in, but at least this gives some restaurants some ability to keep serving. Although it turns out that under the technicalities of BC's still pretty antiquated liquor laws, breweries who don't serve meals have to close their patios. Because I guess eating a steak protects you from COVID when it's done outside.
That is true. I mean, in a very, very roundabout sense, that is true. So the patio program will be something that we can continue to enjoy. Please make sure, like, I think that John Horgan has been a bit of a bozo with trying to blame young people for the upswing in COVID cases rather than taking some responsibility on his role as a government. And, like, I have been relatively pleased with how the government has acted heretofore, but I am a little frustrated with how he has approached this particular issue.
I think that is a pretty universal feeling, judging at least by BC Poly Twitter.
Yeah. Next up, we have the Olympics making a, well, not a return to the city, but a return to our zeitgeist. A report has been returned to City Council called Beyond 2010. Vancouver Council voted to not study a further Olympic bid, but have asked staff to look at the issue, hypothetically, if the consideration of the bid came from somewhere, which is, I mean, quite...
I think we talked in the fall about Council bringing, I think it was specifically Melissa DeGenova, bringing this motion to study a potential 2030 Olympic bid for Vancouver and whether that's something that could reignite the spirit of 2010 in the city. And I think she was pretty excited about it. And there was a couple other people who were interested in it, but I don't think council was that interested. So they did what council tends to do, and they asked staff to think about it a bit. Today, staff came back and Councillor Fry put forward a motion that kicked it back to staff to do a critical cost-benefit analysis now of the previous Olympics and whether it would be a good idea to go forward with further. And that motion passed, and so it's going back to staff. What I found really interesting, though, and what Justin McElroy points out on Twitter, is that the three people to vote against this, presumably to just kill any talk of the Olympics ever again in the city, were Councillors Swanson, Hardwick, and Boyle, who Justin asks, have these three ever voted as the, like, block where they're just the three?
I have no idea, but that is, as he had mentioned, a bit of an unholy alliance.
Yeah, there's definitely been a couple Hardwick-Swanson votes where they're both against development for different
opposite reasons,
but throwing Christine Boyle in there.
Yeah, no, I don't know. And it's hard to draw that cut line. So in that, like, policy space DW nominate thing that I'm so fond of by JSmooth7 on Reddit, I believe, it's, you can usually draw a line through council, a straight line through council that will indicate where people are going to fall on any given vote. One of the big problems with Vancouver Council is that everyone is clumped up in the middle of council, and so there is no governing majority on council. This one would require a big parabola. As there is no way to segue from parabola to the next story, Gregor Robertson's new wife, Eileen Park, has gotten into a flame war with Bob Mackin, who has taken some unusual steps. Ian?
So, I don't have it pulled up in front of me exactly where this started, but Bob Mackin's, he's a Vancouver journalist who now runs a website called The Breaker and is pretty active on Twitter, and he's been covering a number of issues in his mind around China and corruption, in his view. And he is also quite a strong critic of the previous administration, the Vision Vancouver. And in a tweet where he said, Vancouver's ex-mayor became a green celeb in office and had a fling with a Chinese government official's daughter. And he was called out by this, by Eileen Park, the new wife or recently new wife of Gregor Robertson for describing a relationship of 3 years as a fling. And she says, you know, it's something that's been used to keep Asian women oppressed and used to delegitimize and insult. And they kind of start going back and forth, and he criticizes her and says, you should know what your new husband did to this city, kind of thing. And she asks him for any evidence that he has ever stood up against anti-Asian racism. And then he DMs her at one point in this exchange. I have spent more time in Asia than in the United States, mostly China, no, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, but also South Korea and Japan, largely for work. I covered the Beijing Olympics in 2008. I've spent more time in Asia than Ireland, my ancestral homeland. My partner is Asian. If you insist on calling me anti-Asian, which is false and defamatory, then I will have to take legal action against you and cause you to pay for my next trip to Asia. I would appreciate an immediate public retraction and apology. She screenshotted that and shared it with Twitter, and they went back and forth a little bit longer, and eventually he blocked her. A few of the other, like, Van Pauly characters also got in the thread with her, and she held her own, but what a way to get immersed in the toxic cesspool of Vancouver politics Twitter.
Okay, so the big salient point that I have for people here is don't write your own demand letters. Just don't. Hire a lawyer. Hire a lawyer to threaten legal action. Because the lawyer will tell you, no. You're doing a dumb thing. A dumb thing. And that will at least save you from a little bit of public opprobrium.
Also, things that don't prove you're not racist are statements like,
I've been to Asia. My partner is.
It was just a weird moment in Twitter. I didn't know that it needed full covering, but
you know what's a nice moment, a good time story, I guess. Well, not really good times, but at the very least, the city's taking some positive action, at least with the Federal Ministry of Housing. The Granville Street Youth Hostel, which was temporarily converted into housing for the homeless, is going to remain permanently as housing for the homeless at 1025 Granville Street, a site within the Granville Entertainment District in downtown Vancouver. I thank Kenneth Chan for his reporting on Daily Hive for this story. This story was originally leased by BC Housing, and recently, just the other day, Ahmed Hussein, the federal minister responsible for the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation and the Minister of Families, Children, and Social Development, has announced that it is going to be funded under the Rapid Housing Initiative to the tune of $53.1 million, creating up to 188 beds of supported housing across three separate project sites in Vancouver, including the one at 1025 Granville Street. This will be in partnership with BC Housing.
We're seeing a lot of movement in the last, you know, couple years, and especially in the last year, between BC Housing and especially now with the CMHC stepping in to really create new beds, to create new rooms and housing, both quickly in response to the pandemic and more longer term in response to just the state of the world, even before that, the housing crisis and everything we've been facing. It's promising.
What a fucking relief. So one of the things that has been a big problem in housing policy and is the general abrogation of the CMHC, the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, to actually fund housing projects like they used to. They were much more active previously in terms of actually building social housing from a federal level, and that is something that after the 1995 bad news budget, there was a significant reduction in the amount of participation in housing projects by the federal government. Now, this left a large gap that the Ministry of, for some fucking reason, Natural Gas decided to fill. It was because it was Rich Coleman. It was Energy and Mines and Natural Gas and Housing and Gaming and Liquor.
All the other things.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I just really want to see some prestige drama where, like, a rookie RCMP officer gets assigned to white-collar crimes and then realizes, like, slowly over the course of a, 15-episode season that the real villain isn't the gangs or the money launderers or anything. It's actually the ministry that he's
also the RCMP?
Yes.
I just listened to the last episode of the latest season of Commons on Portapique, and It's a mess.
This is Archie Mann's podcast?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very good.
If anyone doesn't listen to that, they should give that a listen to. It is, like, getting back to the issue at hand, a bit of an abomination what our supportive housing system has turned into, and this is a step in the right direction. The federal government needs to continue to be involved in this, and I hope that the Trudeau government manages to keep this going. Like, this is not to diminish or denigrate the accomplishments that Rich Coleman and his ministry did, in fairness, achieve during their time in office, the conversion of a number of SROs being chief among them, but that shouldn't be exclusively a provincial or a municipal responsibility. It has to be shared by all three levels of government through cooperative federalism.
Housing is such a, deep entrenched issue, and I get so many people's frustration that things aren't moving faster, and you look at the headlines from the last, month and a half, and I've lived them in terms of trying to buy a new place and just how wild and unbelievable the market is right now. But the things being done are a good start. They're long-term solutions. There's no quick, easy fixes. I don't know if it's enough. It's probably not. I'm hoping we can still see more. And maybe that's what leads us into the next story.
Yeah. So, Yes'n New West has followed up to opposition in the Aboriginal Land Trust development story. We covered the story two episodes ago, where we mentioned that there was a 1,000 signature petition against a project in New Westminster that didn't, support the Aboriginal Land Trust Society project. Now, basically, some people who signed that project, or that signed that petition against the project, realized what it was saying and kind of thought that they had been a little hoodwinked by the petitioners.
Yeah, the Yes'n New West group, consisting of a handful of people, wrote this nice piece in New West Record, going back through where this petition came from, pointing out that the OCP, the official community plan for the area, does in fact actually say the city should encourage projects exactly like this, but it doesn't seem like the flyers that were handed out to encourage this were not, providing that information to potential signatures.
Yeah, and I think that is really the heart and soul of the story. I'm just going to quote from the article in the New West Record directly. This is an op-ed that was sent in by some people who signed the petition. Quote, "As the thousands of people who received the petition through their mail slots can attest, the petition did not accurately reflect the proposed project or the process the applicant is following in seeking approval from New West City Council." Continuing on later in the letter, they state, "Most notably, policy 8.2C says the city will, quote, partner with senior governments, charitable foundations, faith groups, and nonprofit organizations in the development of affordable and non-market housing. This project is a perfect example of what respect for that policy looks like. Were those 1,000 people made aware of this?" They ask rhetorically. The answer, of course, is fuck no, they were not. Finishing up, they state, "As a community, we define the OCP. It should empower us to achieve these goals, not prevent us from providing vital services like truly affordable housing in our community, in Glenbrook North, and in every neighborhood. Yes, even in our backyard." So, a bunch of people who signed the NIMBY petition turned out to be YIMBYs after all. Thank you indeed.
Another thing that's going to be continuing in our backyard is the temporary bike lane running through Stanley Park. Early in March, the park board considered a motion to allow the trial to run again this summer. This was a huge success by the park board's own numbers last summer, but a number of drivers and business owners in the park got really grumpy about it because it took away a little bit of parking.
Yes, it took away parking and a whole entire lane. So the horse folks will be upset, I guess, because I think they got honked at a bunch. Whether or not we really need recreational carriage rides is another thing entirely. But thankfully, there will be some renewal and well, reconstitution, really, of the bike lane that got so many people through Stanley Park in such a fun way last summer.
It was apparently quite the contentious park board hearing. I watched some of the people live tweeting it, and councillors Trisha Barker and John Cooper, both NPA, were bringing up lots of different defenses. I think at one point they asked whether the Department of National Defense needs to be consulted because they run the cannon there and therefore should have some say on whether the lane being closed.
I'm sorry, I've cracked Ian up. Yeah, no, you don't need to consult. And if the Department of National Defense needed to be consulted, they would have raised hell about it last year. Like, what the fuck?
Ultimately, only the two NPA commissioners voted against it, so it wasn't even close. It was 5-2 in the end.
Something that has actually finally gotten unanimous support is UNDRIP. So the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples has been supported unanimously by City Council resolution. This, of course, is in contrast to a previous vote on the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, where, as an act of quiet protest, Councillor Hardwick deigned to vote against it. Now, during this, Councillor Hardwick and Councillor Bly were both absent. As to their motivations for being absent, I will just remind myself that it is unparliamentary to remark upon the absence of a member. And so we'll leave Councillor Hardwick's motives for being away from that meeting unremarked upon.
This motion is exciting. It does more than just says the words that the city supports UNDRIP. It actually calls for the city to set up a task force to work with the local Indigenous nations, the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples, and we'll start to chart out what exactly UNDRIP in Vancouver means. And so we'll be looking forward to finding that out.
Yes. Lastly, and before we move on to our extra-large edition of Vancouverada this week, there is some pushback over development on Joy Street. Now, this development would, according to the activists who are opposing it, would displace Filipino and Chinese businesses that are considered to be cultural food assets.
So the specific developments are between at 5163 to 5187 Joy Street.
Yeah, and basically, the question is whether or not this is happening as a part of gentrification or is not gentrification. I actually tend to take a bit of a different view on this, in that we are just building apartments in the wrong places. Like, we are not doing our job if we are displacing businesses to build apartments. Even if we are building housing, or rather retail and commercial space on the ground level, because that is like a perfectly reasonable way to build a new neighborhood. However, I want to raise two things. One, we should be building the apartments away from arterials. This was actually the predilection of a planner that didn't get mentioned in our song at the top. Earlier on in Vancouver, around the 50s, the predilection of the city planning department was to put apartments at least one block away from major arterials and have houses on those arterials to provide a buffer. It's the single family housing that should be providing the buffer, not apartments, because there are fewer people in the single family housing. It is a strictly utilitarian question, and if you put the apartments further away, you benefit more people. The other thing that I want to mention is that cultural preservation and heritage preservation does work if done right. This is not endorsing the Hardwick model by any stretch of the imagination, but the heritage of Vancouver is something that is worthwhile protecting. We are coming to the point where we are going to have to start talking seriously about what districts, what areas we want to preserve when it comes to things like the Vancouver Special. There need to be a couple of streets that are set out as preservation neighborhoods to showcase what Vancouver was like in this particular period. Similarly, these type of, you know, cultural food assets often can only exist in heritage buildings or older buildings. I say heritage, I do basically just mean older buildings where commercial rents are lower. If there is to be built a multi-story building that has retail on the ground floor, the cost recovery mechanisms that are available to the building owner are going to displace people and mean that a Tim Hortons and a Royal Bank are going to be moving in down there. Is it always going to be a Tim Hortons and a Royal Bank? No, sometimes it will be a Nando's and a Scotiabank. But rest assured, there's going to be a bank because they're always what moves into these things.
This is a really interesting location. It is almost right under Joyce Collingwood Station. It's one of the East Van SkyTrain stations that's absurdly underdeveloped in terms of density. When you look around it, outside that like little corner, it's all just suburban single-family homes. Some of them are filling in with duplexes now because of the recent changes, but that station in 29th Ave, it's just this like large swath of untouched suburbs. Even once you get into Burnaby at Patterson and Metrotown Station, there are towers there. There are low-rise buildings. Burnaby's quite controversial in that area for replacing some of those affordable low-rises with less affordable towers, but there is more density there. So I get the motivation of developers to try to expand upon this. The other element I find really fascinating of this is the whole hashtag slice of support, which is trying to defend these businesses, is really being championed by a lot of the traditional left-wing in Vancouver, the anti-gentrification crowd. But the interesting thing to me here is that the way that they've done it, and I'm not necessarily criticizing this in any way, is to almost side with small business owners. With now they're within a specific subset of the city, but it's rare, I think, that you see the left coming out in favor of the petite bourgeoisie, as it were. But the cultural and heritage aspects that you speak to, I think, are important. So I don't know the exact right answer here. I don't know where I come down. I find it an interesting debate, and I don't know what the solution is. I do think we need more density in those areas, and I don't know that tearing down these older buildings in favor of just more generic glass towers is the right option.
Yeah, and I feel like because it's along a transit line, there is going to be development pressure, but there do have to be some way of guaranteeing the continued existence of cultural food assets. Now, like one of the things that we want to avoid is the situation in Kitsilano, where there used to be a pretty large Greek community living around 4th Avenue. And there are still a bunch of Greek restaurants that are built around 4th Avenue. But the Greek community, at least according to recent census data, is largely not living around 4th Avenue anymore. They've moved out to cheaper areas where they can have larger homes, some multi-generational housing, again, in that community, as well being relevant. The cultural food assets have remained, however, and they, I think, are valuable. Like, it's valuable to have, you know, one of the most tangible and immediate benefits to multiculturalism preserved in a way that remains accessible to a lot of people. It's something that in Kitsilano was prevented because they didn't build anything off the main roads because of those people who decided to lie down in front of the bulldozers and prevent the construction of, like, four-story walk-ups. Oh no, four-story walk-ups. It's the missing middle we're all so terrified of. And instead, just preserve the neighborhood as it was at a specific time. Hopefully, there is going to be some middle ground found here so that we can get our missing middle, but also not lose the things that make Vancouver special. The multicultural fabric, the multicultural tapestry that makes the city wonderful to live in. And speaking of multiculturalism and indeed Vancouver, the Vancouverada of this week is inspired in part by the absolutely tragic attack on six women of Asian heritage that happened recently in Atlanta. And so we thought it would be appropriate to highlight a couple of the instances in which Vancouver has not been its best when it comes to race relations and talk about Vancouver's history of anti-Asian hate. This goes way back, and
one might even say it's the founding, not myth, the founding principle of this province. I want to highlight a recently released open book by the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives and the Asian Canadians on Vancouver Island Race, Indigeneity, and Trans-Pacific group at the University of Victoria called Challenging Racist, quote, British Columbia, 150 Years and Counting, that you can find at challengeracistbc.ca as a great resource that's now out there to help look at anti-Asian racism as well as anti-Black and anti-Indigenous racism within our own province's history.
So this story was one of Tomikichi Homa, who was a naturalized British subject and one of the first British Japanese settlers in Steveston, walking into a polling booth in 1900 and asking to be placed on the voters' list. This was a deliberate act to challenge the provincial legislation that read, quote,
apologies in advance.
Yeah. No Chinaman, Japanese, or Indian shall have his name placed on the register of voters for any electoral district or be entitled to vote at any election, end quote. Homa was refused. With the support of the community, Homa challenged the matter in court. Both the county court and the Supreme Court of BC ruled in his favor. However, the BC government refused to accept the decisions, appealing to the Privy Council in London. This is before the Canadian Supreme Court was the end-all and be-all of our judicial system.
Yeah, remember the days when, well, I guess they went to the Privy Council then, but I think in the UK, the highest court for longest time and up, and by longest time, I mean up until like 2000, maybe even later, was the House of Lords.
Yeah, that's the JCPC, as the Law Lords. That's the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, so yes, that's the same thing. The Attorney General of the day, DM Eberts, argued, even if they exercise the franchise properly, his words, not mine, it is intolerable that these foreign races, which can never be assimilated into our population, should, in many constituencies, determine who shall represent the people in the legislature.
The Brits agreed.
He says that it's the intolerable. I almost think that that's the goal. Is that the goal? So, yes, the Brits did agree, and voting restrictions remained in place. This was in 1900. Vancouver's history continues with the next major instance of anti-Asian racism flaring up in 1907 with the anti-Asiatic riots, which occurred over the course of 2 days from September 7th to 9th, though in my count that is 3 days, in Vancouver. There were similar anti-Asian riots in San Francisco, Bellingham, and other West Coast cities of North America, part of other broader race riots of 1907. At the time, there were also 8,000 Japanese and around 5,000 South Asians living in the city, in addition to Chinese Canadians. In general, the Japanese community had come to fish. However, in 1907, the panic of 1907, caused by the failure of Augustus Heinze's Brothers Bank in New York, exasperated the difficult labor market and brought racial tensions to the fore. This is again the classic, they took our jobs argument, and this will come up again. Premier Bowser, who we mentioned somewhat less ignominiously earlier on in last year, did not like such large numbers and opposed such a large Asian influence. And in August 12, 1907, members of the Asiatic Exclusion League met and developed a resolution asking the Canadian government to enforce the Immigration Act passed by the provincial legislature in the spring of 1907. But the Canadian government refused to endorse the proposed act.
That have just been because the province shouldn't be passing immigration law? Was that federalism very early on? I'm asking to speculate, but...
My suspicion is that, yeah, the federal government was jealously guarding its prerogatives at that point, rather than being, as the kids say, woke.
Because this is the same federal government that later brought in, or maybe even earlier, I forget the exact date, but definitely brought in head taxes for Chinese immigrants.
Yeah. The Vancouver riots were a direct result of the race riots that happened in Bellingham, Washington on September 5th, 1907. Many of the Chinese victims of the Bellingham race riots fled for Canada, subsequently fueling the Asiatic Exclusion League of Vancouver to take a stance against Asian immigration. At the third meeting of the Asiatic Exclusion League that summer, the members decided to plan a parade for Saturday the 7th of September, including a band to draw attention. It would lead the protesters to City Hall at Hastings in Maine, next to Chinatown, where a rally would be held to address the issues of Asian immigration. When the crowd gathered, they eventually turned into a rioting mob, throwing beer bottles and rocks at windows, attempting to destroy Chinese-owned stores and homes. Most of the buildings during the attack were actually Caucasian-owned, but after the initial attack, the mob of rioters moved to Japantown after destroying Chinese businesses and homes. However, the riots were pushed back by Japanese residents. The Vancouver riot was not finished until 3 o'clock in the morning on September 8th, and by the time dawn had broken, the city had quieted down.
And if you're wondering where Japantown is now, may I refer you to your World War II section of your history books, where we can talk about the internment of Japanese Canadians by the federal government when their houses, property were seized by the government and they were put in concentration camps by our government.
Now, this is actually coming after an RCMP investigation, an extensive RCMP investigation into disloyal activities of Japanese Canadians after the attacks on Pearl Harbor. The RCMP unequivocally stated that there was no problems and that no Japanese Canadians were found to have committed acts of disloyalty during the period either before or after Pearl Harbor. However, the Premier of British Columbia, the Chief of its Provincial Police, and another cabinet minister traveled to Ottawa in December of 1941 and lobbied for, not on grounds of war measures, but on economic and white supremacist grounds, basically, that the 21,000 Japanese Canadians who were living there in British Columbia, primarily making Steveston one of the largest and richest ports in the world, were undercutting white workers, and that was unacceptable. The federal government under Mackenzie King agreed, and while the federal government did apologize for the actions of the previous government in 1988, the provincial government did not apologize until 2012. It was until 1949 that Japanese Canadians were permitted to vote, and it was not until 2009 that a Japanese Canadian was elected to British Columbia's legislature.
Still a long way to go to end the Sinophobia, the anti-Asian racism that is so deeply entrenched in the founding of this province and this city.
And so on that somber note, we ask you to be good to each other and look out in your life for instances where both micro and macro aggressions can make life more difficult and more painful for your friends and your colleagues and your family that are of Asian descent. If you are white, or you are going to be largely blind to this, because it is something that people will do unconsciously. And so, like, it does take some strenuous looking to not only root out these in the broader society, but also to examine one's own prejudices and try and become a better person. It's only through that that we can all be better together. And on the spirit of being better together, we will leave you. Hopefully, we will be back in a couple of weeks as the restrictions are about to lift.
Fingers crossed.
Circuit breaker should have worked by then, or I'm going to have blown a fuse. So, for Leg and Boot Media and the Canby Report, I am Matthew Naylor.
And I am Ian Bushfield.
Good night.